Hello, Internet. Welcome to episode 38 of the Assorted Calibers podcast. The Second Amendment podcast is a little bit for everyone. I'm Weird Beard, and with me, as always, is my lovely hostess, Aaron Paulette. How are you doing, Aaron?
With you, as always?
Want me to do it again?
No. We are keeping this. I'm going to make you flub in the actual show. because I am feeling tired and just a little bit spiteful. I mean, nothing against you, but...
I'd rather be praised than punished, but I'd much rather be punished than ignored.
And yet you claim you're not into BDSM.
Well, not that kind of BDSM.
So this has been a... Well, this has been a day. It's not really been very bad, but it has been a very long day. And for people who follow my Facebook feed, you already know what's going on. And it's not like this really bad news. But today we took my little dog Daisy in to be spayed. Now, just a little story about Daisy here. She originally belonged to a family friend. And this gentleman, Tex... Well, I think he'd had her since she was a puppy, and he died rather unexpectedly, and he was old. I think he tripped and fell and just never recovered from it, and Daisy needed a place to go. Well, Tex's daughter came and thought she could bring Daisy into her home, but the daughter already had a dog, and... she and Daisy didn't get along very well, and so since we were family friends, and because we love dogs, the daughter asked if we would take care of Daisy. And we weren't sure how well she'd get along with our other dog, and Daisy just took to her and took to us right away. And Daisy's just an absolute sweetheart. She is... I say that she is the most kidnappable dog I have ever met, in that... she doesn't know strangers. They're just friends she hasn't met yet. She will come up to you and you know, oh, hello, I'm Daisy, pet me. And, you know, we're on the walk, and she will, like, strain to go meet people, just add them to her fan club. But she doesn't like other dogs, strangely enough. And so it was really strange that she got along so well with our other dog. And she's an absolute sweetheart. We enjoy having her, and that's really helped the loss ever since the other family dog bit me in my face and had to be put down. But we didn't know how old she was, and that was a concern. And then we found out later that, oh, she hasn't been spayed because she's in heat and she's bleeding all over the place. Well, we've got to fix that. And we were operating on just some estimates that she was like maybe 6 or 7, and then... the daughter found a picture of Daisy with her very first litter, and it was dated 2011. And I don't know how old a dog is before they can breed, but, you know, 6 months to a year. So, you know, that could put her at, like, 8 years old. Now, as you know, whenever someone goes under general anesthesia, there's always a chance, however minor, that they don't wake up again. And that chance increases with age. And I've just been really worried because she is an older dog. 7, 8 years old. And I didn't want to deal with the possibility that she would go under and not come up. Because she has really helped heal my heart, helped heal the gap. Okay, I'm going to get really sappy here. But one of the things she loves to do is she loves to lick my face, specifically the scar where I was bitten. And it's almost like I will kiss it and make it better. Just, it's very cute. And I didn't want to deal with the possibility of her not making through this. And so I got on Facebook and I tagged all of my friends that I knew liked dogs. And I just explained the situation. And it's, I'm really scared. I know this is kind of strange, but please humor me. Please pray for my dog, Daisy. Or give well wishes or send vibes or whatever you do. Look, I don't really care what you believe in. Let's just, you know, think good thoughts, positive energy.
I sacrifice the chicken.
Okay, if you eat it. One guy said he would sacrifice many cats. It's like, no, don't do that. You're probably joking, but please don't. But if it's a food animal, that's, I guess, okay. But whatever.
They are delicious. You're... Chickens, yes. Not cats.
So there were, I've lost count. I think it was like around 100 likes and something like 50 some odd people posting a comment. So first of all, I want to thank everyone for doing their part to reassure me, if nothing else, the fact that all these people took the time to say that they were sending good thoughts and praying and vibes and all that other stuff that really set me at ease. And I want to let everyone know that Daisy has pulled through. She's absolutely fine. We got her at about 4:30, and we're recording now. It's like 9:30, and she's mostly okay. She's coming off the anesthesia, and I talked to Weird earlier off the record, and he explained that it's basically like a really bad hangover. And so she's just being really quiet, which is good, because she's normally this really energetic dog, wants to run around and jump and whatever, and she needs to heal those abdominal stitches. So she's just lying comfortably next to Mom on the chair, resting. And other than shakes, which is probably the hangover from the anesthesia, she's doing fine. So thank you, everyone, who took the time to comfort me and put in a good word for my little dog. We are both doing well. Thank you very much. So that said, that was pretty much my day. And I am not as well informed on the topics at hand. I listened to most of the segments, but I'm just going to beg your forbearance. If I don't have anything intelligent to say, this is why. So how are you doing, Weird?
I'm doing pretty good. I'll start off with a little bit of a barb of the, I've been seeing this, this meme popping up on Facebook a lot of the, oh, hey, guess what? I haven't bought a gun all year. It's the, yeah, praise me. It's been a week.
And, wow. I actually haven't seen that, which is odd. I usually get tagged in all the gun memes.
Yeah. Yeah. That's one I've seen, or gun or whatever the person's vice is. Is the I haven't done blank all year. I've been seeing a bunch of them pop. I think I did see a few. I haven't bought a gun, and I will say with most assurance, I have not bought a gun all year because I cannot buy a gun at this exact moment.
Oh no, Weird! What happened? Are you a prohibited person now?
I have paperwork right in front of me that says no, I am not. So I have put in for my renewal for my permit. And of course, being a Massachusetts resident, my permit is not just my permit to carry, but it's also my permit to own, my permit to buy, et cetera, et cetera. And so I, let's see, I got the paperwork in the week before Thanksgiving, and then they have you go in at like a week after the, it was ended up being 2 weeks after, to get your picture taken. And normally they do fingerprints, but I believe they dumped the fingerprint business because the fingerprint scanner that was supposed to verify everybody didn't work. So adorable. I'm sure the gun shops all had to pay for their fingerprint scanners that we all used and whether they worked or not. So went in for that. And when I was there, the nice officer who's been the permit officer in my town since we moved here, was like, yep. All right. Yeah. Everything looks good. Yeah. We got all the information back. I was asking about, I was arrested on a clerical error. In the early 2000s, I was cited for operating a boat that was not properly registered. The owner of the boat paid the ticket, and then I don't know if it was the Marine Patrol or the court or who, but somebody forgot to tell the people upstream that the ticket was paid, and so it went to trial, and I didn't show up because the ticket was paid. And so they issued a bench warrant that I didn't find out about for 2 years because nobody cared that I had a bench warrant for the and I at the time of the I was at the time of the bench warrant, I was living at the address on the ticket. Like, all they had to do was pick up the phone and say, "Hey, man, can we take you alive?" And yeah, I ended up getting pulled over on my way home from a wedding by an officer fresh out of the academy. And when I rolled down the window, he was laughing. He's like, "Is this your name?" "Yeah." "Have you ever lived in Bar Harbor, Maine?" "Yeah, a couple years ago. I worked there for a summer." He goes, "You're not going to believe this, but I have a warrant for your arrest." And yeah.
Good joke, officer.
Yes.
No, I'm serious. Get out of the car.
If anybody knows how to get mug shots, like, I would love to have my mug shot. I tried to look it up because there is one mug shot of me and I am wearing a suit and tie because I was on my way home from a wedding. But yeah, I said, "Yeah, did you guys find that information?" Because I realized, oh man, where the heck did I write down the information? I couldn't remember. I knew within a year or so, and what? And I'm just like, oh God, because they ask all of your court things. Just recently now, this is a new thing. They want to know every carry permit you've ever had, including expired permits. So I'm just like, what?
So I want to circle back here because I have never heard this story. All right, so you get pulled over for some sort of vehicular infraction. You have a new officer.
Not even that. I got pulled over. So the wedding was on was at the Black Point Inn in Scarborough, Maine, which if anyone's ever been there, which probably is none of you, but it's a beautiful resort at the out on the ocean, and on it is a long road that is flanked with mansions, probably owned mostly by out-of-staters. And the speed limit is, it's a long, straight road that's well lit, and the speed limit is 25 miles per hour, and it is a notorious speed trap. One member of the wedding party and two people from the band got speeding tickets during the rehearsal dinner. And so I get out, and as soon as I pull out of the parking lot, a police cruiser comes down and then pulls. It's the end of the road, so he turns around in that parking lot, and it's right on my tail. So I set my cruise control at 1 mile under the speed limit because everyone was warning everybody, do not go over 25 when you leave this place because you will get pulled over. And so I'm driving, and it's like 2 miles of road at 24 miles an hour. And I'm just telling my wife, I'm just like, she was my girlfriend at the time. Yeah, keep your eye in the rearview mirror and just let me know when those lights come on. Because at this point in time, they're going to come on. And I get from, it goes from like 25 to like 45 when you get off of it. And so I just downshift and just get the heck out of there because I'm just sick of being tailed by this cop. And as soon as I downshift, I hadn't even gotten to the new posted speed limit. The lights come on. She's like, they're on. And I'm just over asking her to get the registration and insurance information out of the glove compartment, and he's knocking on my window. Normally they're doing stuff. He got bored following me. He knew that he wasn't going to get me for speed, so he ran my plates. And my truck was registered to the name of Weirdbeard, the notorious felon. He's been on the lam for 2 years. No one's been able to catch him.
They call him Tater Salad.
Exactly. So that's why he was laughing. Is I got he pulls up a bench warrant that is 2 years old, and the information is all correct to with everything else that he's seeing. So it wasn't like I'd moved around or there's any reason why they wouldn't have been able to find me. They both knew immediately. Him and his partner knew that no, the reason why they hadn't found me is because no one looked for me.
Okay, I mean, I'm not really sure why he's laughing at you being arrested. Seems kind of like a dick move.
No, he's just amused that it put me at ease. It was absolutely the appropriate reaction at the time. Literally said, like, yeah, no, this seems like complete BS.
Okay, but you said you got arrested.
Yes.
So did he handcuff you, put you in the back of the car, give you the ride to downtown?
There's the good news. He let me know that because it was like 10 o'clock at night and there was a bench warrant out for me. Yes, ideally, he should be, you know, by the book, he should cuff me and throw me in the back of the car. But because it was such a goofy warrant, they ended up saying, look, just follow us. We're right by the police station. Follow us back to the police station. And then they called and woke up the bail bondsman and had him come in. And so, like, literally, it was the three of us and then the bail bondsman. My girlfriend, now wife, were the only people in the Scarborough Police Department at the time. So yeah, so they really did me a solid. I ended up calling up their superior officer and saying, like, no, this was something that could have ruined my night, and it really wasn't a good thing to have for the end of my night. But let me tell you, they made it as good as could be. And so I'm like, yeah, I don't know what else I could do, but I'm just saying, like, these guys are awesome. Like, they couldn't have handled it better. It's like one of them was fingerprinting me and taking my mugshot. The other one was sitting there talking to my wife and keeping her company, so she wasn't just sitting out in the empty lobby of the police station. But yeah, it ended up going like had to go to trial you know, I had talked to a lawyer and he was just like, yeah, just see if they can get him to dismiss it. And at that point in time, the Marine Patrol agent who was supposed to be overseeing it, I was the last person on the docket for him. And he just went, yeah, I'm gone. And so couldn't get anybody to talk to about dropping that. So I ended up calling them up just to get the information for the, you know, the actual trial. And they went, why are you calling about this? I said, well, I was arrested on a bench warrant and yeah, it's going to go to trial. And they're like, are you going to be at this number? Yeah. They called me back like 20 minutes later going, yeah, where can we send the check for your bail money? they had found the ticket, found that it was paid and went, yeah, why is this here?
Well, I'm pleased that they had the integrity to send you the check for your bail money.
Yes, but every time I undergo any sort of background check, be it a new employer or a gun permit or any sort of thing like that, like, I have to write down that stupid story every single time. But yeah, now Massachusetts is asking for like all of my old permits. So like, I had a Maine permit and a New Hampshire permit. I let them both go because now those two states are constitutional carry. And yeah, technically you can still get the permits there and there's reasons to have them, but I'm not going to bother. There's money I can spend on other things. You don't need to spend a gazillion dollars every couple of years on gun permits. That's why we need concealed carry reciprocity. Just get your permit and keep your permit and there you go. But they needed like the numbers on all those permits and what years they were issued. And I'm like, really? What's going on here? But yeah, so then the officer was nice to inform me that I would probably get my permit. Everything looked good. And I'd probably get my permit in a couple of months.
Yeah, a couple of months. And your permit expires when?
Expired on my birthday, January 1st.
Okay, so I want to make this absolutely plain to people. You got the notice that it was due for renewal. You went in before the expiration date to get it renewed. They told you that it would be several months until it got renewed. It has been several months, and you haven't gotten it back yet, correct?
Correct. Correct. I'm expecting it probably around the end of February.
Okay. So does this mean that until you get your permit, you can't carry? Or is there some degree of grace period involved? I can't even say that with a straight face. This is Massachusetts.
That's absolutely in the law. So first up, let's not bury the lead here. The law says they have 40 days to give me my permit back or to issue me a permit or issue me a denial. And I mentioned that to the officer and he chuckled and said, well, you can always sue the police if you want. I do need to, now that the holiday rush is over, I am going to be calling the Gun Owners Action League of Massachusetts and just see if there's any sort of class action lawsuit business going on right now, because I mean, this is nonsense. And while, no, I'm not going to go on an individual vendetta against my local police department, this is just wrong. But there is a grace period. I have, either if you move into the state with firearms, legally owned firearms, or your permit expires, so long as there's an application in the works, you have 90 days. And so technically speaking, my permit is not valid, but also kind of valid.
It's valid enough for the ones you have, but not valid enough to get a new gun.
I cannot buy a gun. I cannot buy ammunition. He said, yeah, it might be a good idea not to carry. I am not following that. I have the piece of paper that shows that my paperwork has been submitted and that the local background check was completely clean. And at this point in time, you know what? If you want to make me into a test case, I'm your Huckleberry.
So I hope you were a good little prepper and you stocked up on ammo.
I did. I mentioned that to you when I first got the bad news in November, and you're like, well, buy ammo, and I'm like, yeah, I actually just bought 5,000 rounds just the other day. So
a good start.
Yep. It'll go, and I'm not going to go too hog wild and shooting it all up. But and of course, also, I mean, I'm a gun nut. Like, I've got like cases and cases of ammo behind me anyway.
So because this is relevant, mm-hmm. and not deliberately to tweak you, but that's a fortunate side effect. I, too, received notification that I needed to renew my concealed weapons license. And here's what's involved with me. I either need to fill out this form and mail it in, or do it online, and I need to get one passport-type color photograph and a check or money order for $45, and that's it.
Don't you need to have it notarized if you're doing the mail thing? Because I've got a Florida permit as well.
Well, there are differences for out-of-state residents.
Okay, that might be it.
For example, out-of-state residents must submit a completed fingerprint card, but I don't have to.
Okay.
And I know that I needed to get it notarized when I first filled out my application paperwork, but there's nothing here that I can see, although I'll take another look, mm-hmm. That says it has to be notarized. I mean, on the back, there is an affidavit of continued eligibility that I must sign. Mm-hmm. And this affidavit is executed under oath. Falsification or misrepresentation of any part or any document subjects the applicant to criminal prosecution under Section 837.06 Florida statutes. So I'm not a bureaucrat. I'm not a lawyer, but I would think that that means I don't have to get it notarized again.
Yeah. Well, either way, I also have what is the actual term for the Florida permit? Is it
concealed weapons permit?
It's a weapon.
Because it's not just for a pistol. It does cover other things.
Mm-hmm. Yep, concealed weapon or firearms license, state of Florida. There's my old one. I just renew mine when I'm in Florida visiting my father-in-law, I just drove into the sheriff's office. I don't forget what it's just Department of Agriculture, isn't it?
Yes. Yeah. Department of Agriculture.
Yeah. So I just drove into the Department of Agriculture office, and they'll take your picture. They'll do the fingerprint thing. They'll do all the stuff for you. I ended up bringing in a passport photo because I didn't realize they did all that stuff in house. Next time, I'm just gonna bring money, just bring my checkbook, and they do all that stuff. The guys, they're all wicked cool. And unlike Massachusetts, I think my permit beat me home. So just to add insult to injury, on one sale, I also renewed my driver's license at about the exact same time. And I got that back in 2 weeks. It might even been 1 week, but it showed up faster than I expected. Also, another interesting thing is, of course, longtime listeners of the show and all that have heard about Mara Healy and her, really, it's straight up criminal reinterpretation of our assault weapons ban. And all the gun shop owners that I've talked to have said, yeah, the moment they transfer any sort of either a pre-ban AR or transfer one to on law enforcement letterhead, they get a phone call from the state police like immediately. And they're like, oh, yeah, no. They hired new people to be watching the transactions that are going through just to make sure that nobody's selling some guns under the radar. So, yeah, they hired new people just to make sure that this illegal action is enforced. But the legally required action of people's right to keep and bear arms, yeah, no, that's a low priority. Uh-huh. They'll get it done when they do. We'll take a long lunch and a smoke break.
Jeez. Well, I just want to say that I am very happy to be renewing my license because the picture I have on mine is awful. It's awful. I got my picture taken at a local sheriff's department. You know, the people who do mugshots. Mm-hmm. And, well, okay, it's not flattering. Most pictures aren't. But this picture is taken actually at a low angle. And look, I am not tall. I am like 5'4", 5'5" on a really good day. I swear, I think the camera was at about the 4-foot height and was angled up.
Ugh.
And so it gives the impression of me kind of being haughty and having my head back and looking down my nose. And then, of course, the flash casts all these weird shadows. And I swear to God, I look like American ISIS. I mean, if I ever become a person of interest for any sort of thing, that is the picture they're going to dig up and show on the news.
Oh, God.
I don't care how old it is. That's the one they're going to show. I mean, I'm looking like Al-Qaeda Unabomber in that picture. It's awful. Oh, my God. It's horrible. And so I am just so happy to be rid of it.
Yeah. Well, good on that. And I'm sure you'll get it in a couple of days. All right. Yeah,
I don't know about a couple of days.
Yeah. I'm just rolling my eyes at every other state does this correctly, and Massachusetts, who also happens to be the added benefit. Look, I mean, during the Obama gun rush, when like there was no 22, and we all remember that, that was also a year that I had to renew my permits. And yeah, my main permit took like extra long to renew, and so it was one of those like I think there was like a month. There was a month where I wasn't licensed. It wasn't legal to carry in Maine. I could have brought guns if I was going to go shoot with some friends up in Maine. I could have brought guns with me. You know, I could buy guns up in Maine. I could buy ammo up in Maine. You know, there was really the only thing that changed was I was not able to carry concealed up in Maine for about a month. In Massachusetts, it's everything. I mean, it's I mean, I asked him. He said, you know, the police officers can just in the cruiser just check and verify, yes, indeed, this permit is in the grace period. So there's not going to be a question of me driving down to the range and being pulled over for an out taillight. And they go, oh, man, I see your range bag in the back seat. And I see a box of federal ammunition poking out of the top of that. So you got guns. Let's have a look at them and let's see your permit. And it'll be a question. Well, yeah, the expiration date was, you know, 2 weeks ago, but I'm
off
still
to the pokey with you.
Exactly. Until we sort this out. No, it'll be sorted out right there. And honestly, at this point in time, yeah, send me the friggin' pokey. let's end this right here, right now. I've documented everything.
I have a toddler. I need the vacation.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. Trust me, my cellmate's temper tantrums are nothing like hers.
A nice, relaxing night in the drunk tank.
Mm-hmm. So speaking of Massachusetts laws, I thought it would be fun to invite my friend Jay Grazio of Shooting Illustrated to talk about what it's like to grow up with Massachusetts gun laws. All right. Joining me again is Jay Grazio, host of the Squirrel Report and managing editor of Shooting Illustrated. How you doing, Jay?
I'm doing great. Weird. Thanks for having me on.
So here's something I really wanted to talk about, because we almost kind of have like a backwards relationship with firearms, is that I grew up in an anti-gun household and got into shooting later in life. I took my first shots at 19. I think it was like 24 when I first got my carry permit. But I grew up in Maine, which is a very, very gun-friendly state. And you, on the other hand, have been a lifelong gunny. Is that a correct assessment?
That is a very correct assessment, yes.
So you've been a lifelong gunny, but you lived all the way up until recently in Massachusetts, which is pretty much, is it safe to say that Massachusetts has pretty much always been hostile to gun ownerships, at least in our lifetime?
In our lifetime, yes.
I've read the history books. I know about Lexington and Concord.
No, but going back even into the 80s, there were sand pits down behind what would become the town hall that, you know, were open for people to go shoot at. You know, my mom very clearly remembers taking a 22 rifle down to the old dump, you know, shooting rats at the dump.
That sounds like fun.
You know, it sure does. I wish we had Nutria like in Louisiana.
I've heard they taste good too.
I don't know if I'd eat rodent, but they're a bigger target than rats. So, but anyway, you know, so at some point post 1980s, it got really bad.
So why don't you give me, let's start all the way to like your earliest memory, Jay. Tell me about your childhood. why don't you tell me about like your earliest memories of gun? So your father was a police officer.
My father was a state cop, and, you know, just growing up, he knew that, you know, as a police officer, if I, you know, as a kid, I'm naturally going to be curious. And dad's a cop. I see him in uniform. I see him with his gun. He knew I was going to be curious about it from a very young age. Like literally before I can even remember, before I form memories, he showed me how to load and unload and how to make sure it was empty. And he was, you know, he was always, anytime you want to see dad's gun, just ask me. You know, and there were a couple of times where I was like, hey, dad, that's a different one. Like when he was doing some plainclothes work and he had, I mean, this was, to tell you how long ago this was, he was on the Mass State Police and he was issued a Smith & Wesson Model 66, a stainless steel 357 Magnum revolver. This is long before they were doing semi-autos. But he had a, oh my gosh, I'm drawing a blank on the, I don't remember the exact model numbers. He had a 4-inch barrel that he carried in full uniform and a 3-inch barrel that was his plainclothes gun. So when I saw that it was a different gun, I was like, dad, what's that? So he stopped and showed me, went through the same. He asked me to unload it while he was right there. And just from that point on, my grandfather was a town cop for like 4 decades. And, he had 2 gun cases that they were in his basement and they're in my basement now, which I think is kind of cool. He, you know, my grandfather growing, living through the Depression, he had a diner back in the 40s, you know, immediate post-depression in the late 30s and early 40s. And he would take firearms as payment for diner bills. You know, people would run up a tab at the diner and pay him off with like a pump action 22. So he had a number of guns in these gun cabinets. So every time I go over to see my grandpa, it was like, oh, cool. Look at all this cool stuff. And he had a 1911, an actual honest to goodness World War I 1911, and, you know, a couple of rusty old revolvers and a whole bunch of shotguns.
So when did you take your first shots?
Well, I remember now, you know, going back to the whole Massachusetts thing, I remember going out in the woods with my dad with the Stevens 410 shotgun. I was probably like 8. That was the first time, and I didn't do much shooting until I was probably 18 and going to the public range. You remember Bob's Tactical in Salisbury? I think we went there a handful of times.
Oh, okay. Yeah, not super well, but yeah.
Anyway, the public range not very far from my house, and I had a friend who enjoyed going shooting, and he was like, hey, let's, you know, we're doing the usual teenager, what do you want to do tonight? He was like, have you ever been shooting before? And I was like, well, I, you know, shot a shotgun with my dad a couple of times and went to the range. You know, I was probably 17 at the time, or I might have been 18. I think I had to be 18. But, and from that point on, it's just been, you know, steadily rolling.
So, all right, now we're up to 18. So in your, you know, your teenage years and all that, did you find that there were in your, you know, school and neighborhood and friends and, you know, family members, were there a lot of people gun friendly? Were they anti-gun? What's, were guns talked about at all, or was that how does that work out?
I think mainly it was, you know, friends who were curious about guns because they knew my dad was a cop. And, you know, so it would be like, you know, oh, hey, you know, can we see these? And it would be like, we can look at them in the case, but we're not going to touch because we, you know, we're being safe and that's good. But other than a curiosity, it really wasn't a big thing. I think even then there wasn't a very strong gun culture in Massachusetts. Mm-hmm. You know, it's just kind of, you know, what you knew about guns, you knew about it from seeing it on TV.
So it wasn't quite like, because you lived in a fairly rural part of Massachusetts.
Yeah.
Because I know that, I mean, I grew up just outside of Portland, so there was not a whole lot. There was some kids in my school that hunted, but when I went up to Orono, Maine to go to college, I started meeting the kids that were like, oh yeah, no, like at 8 years old, like I was going into the gun safe and pulling out my .22 and going out into the cow pasture and shooting groundhogs. You know, and my dad was super happy about that because the groundhogs were ruining the pastures and making it dangerous for the cattle. So, but you didn't have any of that. Those kids that were born with a .22 in their hand.
No, not really. It's, you know, it's just, it wasn't really a big thing. Like, you know, like I mentioned, there was a time when, you know, you could go shoot rats at the dump, but by the time I was of age, it really wasn't a thing. I mean, I got my, and this is getting real into the weeds in Massachusetts, but I got my FID card, which was a permit to own basically shotguns and rifles when I was 15 and never did anything more with it. I had it because I may need to go buy ammunition. Mm-hmm. So,
but you needed a permit to buy ammunition even back then.
Even in the 80s, mm-hmm. You know, but I mean, that's also when you could buy ammunition at Kmart and service merchandise and,
oh,
you
service
know.
Merchandise.
Yeah.
I don't think they even exist anymore.
I don't think so. Yeah. I mean, you did need a permit and, you know, you had at the time there were three classes of permits. There's the FID, which was like rifles and shotguns, and then class B, which nobody ever got because it was dumb. And, that was basically rifles and low capacity handguns. And then class A was everything. So yeah. When my grandfather passed away, I was 22, 23. And because I was the one gun nut in the family, he had promised me his firearms when he passed on. And there were several handguns in there. And I needed my Class A for the handguns. So I got my Class A permit. And so it was 1994. I've had a permit to carry since 1994, which is kind of,
and your town didn't give you any trouble with that.
Not to get too into the weeds on Mass, but permits are, I don't know if you've talked about this before.
A little bit, yes, about the
May issue. So, you know, it's May issue, which is the licensing authority, and it varies from town to town. There are some towns that will flat out not issue any, and there's some towns that are, as long as you're not a criminal, and our town, They want you to have a restricted permit before they give an unrestricted, but because I'd had an FID for 9 years and, you know, there'd never been any problems, they granted the Class A unrestricted. So
I know for some people in Massachusetts, when they're in a town where there might be some sort of restrictions put on, because that was me when I moved to Massachusetts, I had a restricted permit for 10 years before right. I finally moved to where I live now, where they don't give restricted permits because they're dumb. So your father didn't have to, or grandfather didn't have to pull any strings. Cause I know some people that live in towns where the police might be a little bit more of the, we don't necessarily issue to everyone, or we're going to make you do extra things. If you know somebody in local politics or in public service, that could sometimes sway things, but you didn't have to call in any favors or no strings were pulled?
No, my dad helped me fill out the application. You know, it's like, no, just say this, you know, they ask you the reason, you know, reason for issuing. It's, you just tell it all lawful purposes. You know, don't give them a reason to deny you by saying, well, I just feel like carrying, you know, my rights or anything that you should be able to, but because they have the ultimate power, and don't give them any reason to say no.
Yeah, that's always the scary thing about living here in Massachusetts, is that they can just take away your permit, and it's not your permit to carry, your permit to own.
Right. And now it's, you know, you have to get rid of everything, including ammunition. So
Were you 21 at that? Or you said you were 24?
23. I was 23 at the time.
Yep.
So, yeah, you know, I had my permit then and just...
Were you carrying right off? Because when you get a Class A that's not restricted, that is your carry permit. So that can be a little interesting because a lot of people they'll buy their first gun and they'll have guns for a little while before they end up filling out paperwork and getting their carry permit. In Massachusetts, you have to do all the work to get your carry permit. Even for my case, my first permits were restricted, but I went through all the hoops that you went through to get your permit to carry. So were you carrying right off the bat or was there some time when?
Oh, a little bit. But, you know, just not very regularly. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, it wasn't really it wasn't a huge deal. It was just like, you know, I mean, the first handful of times, it was a novelty. I'd never carried before. And, you know, I had a chief special and then my Makarov, which are not ideal carry guns. All steel 380s that weigh 18 pounds and have a, you know, 14 pound trigger.
And a safety that goes backwards.
Yes. Yes. But in Soviet Russia, safety goes up. Just over the years, once I got into writing and was reviewing more guns, I started, acquiring more, but just always been interested.
How much did you encounter any trouble back when you were freelance writing when people wanted to send you stuff for review and not realizing how tough Massachusetts is to gun owners?
Oh yeah, all the time. There'd be someone who wanted to send something that wasn't on, for example, the approved handguns roster, you know, and you know, it kind of limited what I could test. I mean, I couldn't test any Glocks because they're not on the roster. I couldn't test any, I guess HK eventually came on the roster, but not,
yeah, not at the time.
Yeah, not a lot in the late aughts. But, you know, and then, of course, if it was a rifle, it had to be assault weapon ban compliant and no 30-round magazines. So, but, you know, plenty of those are available. So that was less of an issue than for handguns. The town I grew up in and lived in until I moved out was very good. And I didn't encounter any problems with renewals or whatnot. But I just remember... Every time my permit came up for renewal, it was just that fear that they could literally say no for any reason.
Yeah. No, I've got to send mine in for renewal in the fall. And yeah, every time I think about it, including right now, I kind of get that lump in my throat.
Yeah. You know, and it's something you just don't think about. You know, now that I'm in Virginia, it's like, you know, first of all, they're shall issues. So I haven't done anything to disqualify me. So they have to issue it. But even if for whatever reason, I don't lose all my guns.
Yeah. Well, that's during my last renewal period. So when I got my carry permit, I just said, oh, now I'm going to start carrying. So I'm going to get, you know, my New Hampshire permit and my Maine permit and my Florida permit. And so when they're up for renewal, like they're all up for renewal. And it was the Obama boom back when you couldn't get like any guns or any ammunition anywhere. And surprise, surprise, it was a huge backlog for carry permits. So
yeah.
Both my Maine permit and my Massachusetts permit expired.
Ooh.
And the Maine one was okay. That's a pain, but it just means that when I travel to Maine, I'm not going to leave the guns at home. I'm not going to carry a gun.
Right.
The Massachusetts permit, technically speaking, there is a grace period. If you have a renewal in the system, you're given, I think, 90 days.
Yeah.
For them to deny you. And I think it was like 85 days after it expired. And this now noting, I did like 60 days before the permit actually expired was when I had the paperwork in.
Yep.
But that's terrifying. And it was one of those, like, I was not even going to the range. Like, I just one of those, yep. I don't want to get pulled over with guns in the car.
Exactly. Even though you have all the paperwork and everything is right, it's, you know, you don't, because it snowballs. Because if you went to the range and let's say you're sitting in a light and somebody rear ends you. You know, you are doing absolutely nothing wrong. And when the authorities show up, they look in and they see a gun box and, you know, hey, what's going on? You say, oh, I was going to the range. Okay, that's fine. Can I see your permit? And then you're like, well, technically.
Yeah. Well, you hand them a permit and it is expired. I mean,
right.
I got trouble from gun shops because I was giving him a permit that didn't have my address on it because I had recently moved in, and you can transfer the permit, but it's one of those like, oh, this has got a different address on it from your mailing address. I don't know about that.
Yep. It's unnerving. It's you know, you just spend, you know, the permits are good. What are they good for? It's like five years. Yeah. And so you get about 4 years and then it's like, I have to renew next year. And then you start with that. But it was like, it was good for 5 birthdays. So basically you renewed it. If you renewed it the day after your birthday, you got an extra year. And my town was like, oh, no, come in the month of your birth and we'll process it. And I was always like, I don't want to wait that long. I want to have it in 60 days ahead. But they'd be like, no, just come in the first of the month. Now, small town, didn't have as many people applying for permits. So they were pretty good at processing them in a timely manner. I never had to wait 85 days. It was, you know, like usually 4 weeks. You know, so basically it would expire on my birthday. I'm born on the 21st, and you know, by the following week I'd have it. So it wasn't terrible, but you know, still there was that like one, you know, there'd be a couple of weeks where it's just like I firmly think that, you know, they took a look at the list of the firearms I own and said, no, we got to renew his permit because we don't have the space to store all these. We can't take them away.
Break the leaf springs on the truck.
We need to rent the truck. That apprehension that you really, you know, it's unfortunate. There's really no reason for it. You know, it shouldn't happen, but it does. And that's why we advocate for change.
Well, thanks so much, Jay. Like, I really wanted to know, like, I actually never heard, like, the whole story. I've heard bits and pieces of all of this, but I'd never actually heard all of it. And I think maybe people might be interested to know, you know, especially since so many of the, you know, if you're a lifelong gun nut, oh, you probably grew up, you know, in a gun-friendly state. I mean, if you're listening to this right now, you're probably in a gun-friendly state. Most states are. Or if you're one of the people that maybe came into firearms later in life, you didn't necessarily know what it was like growing up in,
right,
you know, in a pro gun household, or specifically a pro gun household in an anti gun state.
Yeah, few and far between. But you know, one parting thought, and I know you've mentioned this before, when you do come across gun enthusiasts in hostile states, they tend to be all in. You don't find someone in a state like Mass or New York who's like, oh, I kind of like guns. I have a rifle and that's it.
Yeah. In Maine, you know, someone that might have a revolver, yeah, in their sock drawer and a shotgun, maybe a rifle kicking around. In Massachusetts, you know, you're laying out $100 every 5 years.
Yeah.
It's just that $100 Mossberg shotgun that you have, it just is going to be like, you're going to be spending way more for the permit to have it than you did on the shotgun, you know, after a couple of years. So why not have 30 guns?
Exactly. It's, oh, one gun a month, challenge accepted.
Well, thanks so much, Jay.
Thank you for having me on. I really appreciate it.
Well, that's good. And you can read more from Jay at shootingillustrated.com and hear him on the Squirrel Report. I had to know, because he grew up in a gunny family, but in Massachusetts, and he came of age when Massachusetts was definitely gone to the dark side. And so that is Jay's story of growing up in Massachusetts as a gun nut.
So I've probably mentioned it before. I think I've mentioned it on this very podcast. I have asked you how Massachusetts, that worships the founding fathers and the American Revolution, where citizens took up guns against the British, how the birthplace of liberty has now become the grave of liberty. What the hell?
Yeah, man, it's just the modern politics. And I just don't even need to get into that, like, rage-inducing subject of how, yeah, we have gone to a place where, oh, yeah, no, there's, like, the Minuteman statues on, like, everything, and there's all the talk of John Adams, and we have Patriots Day here, where there's reenactments of the Patriots fighting the British, and, yeah, man, it's... But no, that doesn't account to anybody else. Just
the Second Amendment only applies to muskets, but the First Amendment totally applies to my cell phone.
I've got to say, it's it reminds me, hopefully not to touch a third rail, it reminds me of the people that are flag waving women's rights, women's lib, you know, I support, you know, women and power to the ladies. And then at the same time, get like super upset when somebody criticizes like a fundamental Muslim on their treatment of women. And it's just one of those like, what are you doing? Or actually a better example is the here in Massachusetts, we are legalizing marijuana and cracking down on cigarettes.
What?
Yep.
Oh, my brain hurts.
Yep, that's how it works here. It's opposite land.
Last week, David talked about the various styles of concealed carry, but in order to carry, you need a good holster. In this week's episode of Gun Lovers and Other Strangers, David talks about your various options when it comes to holsters.
Hi, and welcome to Gun Lovers and Other Strangers. Now for the latest installment in my continuing series on concealed carry options. For those who've been listening to my segments regularly, you know I work at a local gun shop. A question came up at work the other day about what's the best holster material. Obviously, that question is incomplete. You have to define the requirements that the holster needs to fulfill before you can choose the material. It would be like asking Oddball what's the best knife steel. Not enough information. When it comes to holster selection, my list of requirements tends to be as follows. By the way, these are in no particular order as they shift depending on other variables. Retention. Does the holster retain the pistol and prevent it both from falling out during normal activity as well as delaying someone making a grab for my handgun? Safety. Does the holster completely cover the trigger guard of my handgun and, since I carry a 1911, prevent the thumb safety from being pushed off inadvertently? Concealability. If I'm carrying concealed, which I usually do outside of work, does the holster hold the pistol close to my body in the preferred carry position, making it easier to conceal under a cover garment? Access. When I attempt a proper draw, does the holster release my handgun readily? In addition, are there any straps, levers, or latches I have to release as part of the draw? Reholstering. Can I easily reholster my handgun one-handed? This may be very important following a defensive shooting incident. I am purely talking about getting the pistol back in the holster, not dealing with cover garments. Comfort. If you've ever worn an uncomfortable holster, you know the constant adjustments you tend to make in order to keep the holster from rubbing, pinching, or chafing. All of these movements are major tells if you're trying to carry concealed. On the other hand, with a properly fitted holster, you may even forget you're carrying. On the gripping hand, comfort may need to take back seat to some of the other considerations. So, where does this leave us for holster materials? As you may have guessed from my carry gun, I'm something of a traditionalist. Therefore, my preferred holster material is generally leather. Leather has worked for this type of purpose literally since before there were handguns. It's soft, so it won't scratch your gun, relatively impervious to oils and solvents, long wearing with proper care, and, when properly designed and constructed, looks good to boot. It does, however, have some downsides. Over time, leather can soften and not hold the gun as securely, or, if not properly cared for, harden and crack. Leather can absorb sweat, holding moisture against the gun, which can cause rust, and, when carried inside the waistband, leather holsters tend to collapse, making reholstering more difficult. While there are many generic quality leather holsters on the market, I'd rather have something custom-made. For that, I'm particularly fond of Dragon Leatherworks out of Oak Ridge, Tennessee. They offer a few designs in a dizzying variety of leathers and options. As a bonus, if you watch NCIS, you may have seen some of their designs on screen. I'll ask for the link to their website be added in the show notes. Next is holsters made of plastic. Whether Kydex, carbon fiber, or some other formulation, these are hard shell holsters used in everything from competition to law enforcement to personal carry. Single-layer plastic holsters are, generally, form-fitted to a specific model of gun. This makes for an excellent fit with no need of additional retention elements. Plastic holsters come in both inside and outside the waistband variants, with some holsters able to be carried either way simply by switching the belt loops or clips. As they're hard-sided, reholstering one-handed in an inside-the-waistband plastic holster is usually not an issue. Many current offerings also come standard with what's called a sweat shield. This is an extension on the inside face of the holster that sits between the rear of the pistol and your body. both protecting the metal from your sweat and offering more comfort. While, in my opinion, they are not as attractive as leather holsters, various colors and finishes are available. Also, they're not quiet when unholstering or reholstering, and the plastic can wear through most finishes over time. Also, as I experienced recently, some of the earlier formulations become brittle over time and develop cracks. I had to retire an inside-the-waistband plastic holster that had seen me through nearly 8 years of daily carry. My current inside-the-waistband concealment holster was made by Fury Carry Solutions in Maryville, Tennessee, and I'm very happy with their quality, price, and delivery time. They make most of their holsters and accessories to order, so there's often a few weeks between order and delivery. If you get one of their holsters, I recommend also getting the IWB hooks. They are designed so that you can tuck your shirt in over the holster, leaving only the clips visible. A nice touch. I'll ask for their website to be put in the show notes as well. You can use the code FRIEND and they'll take 10% off whatever you buy. In other words, speak friend and enter your order. Finally, we come to fabric holsters. Honestly, I'm not a fan. They frequently have all the flaws of soft leather holsters with few of the benefits, such as passing moisture, difficult reholstering, and holding the gun less securely. The one thing they do offer is price. Fabric holsters are generally very inexpensive. However, you can get a basic plastic or leather holster for not much more, and that's what I would recommend. Of course, the best holster in the world can't work without a quality belt, assuming it's a holster to be used with a belt, of course. Again, the two main choices are leather and synthetic. Probably the most important feature in a good carry belt, regardless of material, is stiffness. You want it to hold up your holstered handgun without rolling or twisting. As you might expect, I prefer a leather belt with a traditional buckle. Currently, I use a nearly 20-year-old belt made by Galco that, while showing some wear, holds up just fine. However, I am looking to get a nylon belt with an infinite adjustment buckle for experimentation. With this type of buckle, there are no holes in the belt for a prong to go through. Instead, the buckle contains some form of friction system to hold the belt in place. Pros and cons of these belts are that a traditional buckle is limited in adjustments, while the other type really does offer infinite adjustment. On the other side, a traditional buckle offers easy repeatability, while the infinite buckle is like adjusting a car seat. Easy to get good enough, challenging to get just right. Most importantly, whatever carry style, whichever holster and belt you choose, make sure to practice carrying around the house and in different outfits before you carry for real. In addition, practice drawing with an unloaded gun as part of your familiarization process. That's all for now. Thanks for listening. I'm David, and this is Gun Lovers and Other Strangers.
So, Weird, what is the slang term for the really crappy Uncle Mike's type holster?
Sausage sack is the term that I frequently use.
Sausage sack, there we go. Is it because gun equals penis equals slang for that is sausage? And it's the sack you stick your sausage in? Or am I completely overthinking this, which is increasingly likely?
I always thought it was just the amorphous nature of it. It was just like packing filling into a sausage casing. Because most of them are universal, so.
Oh, okay. So in this analogy, the holster is actually the intestine into which you pack the sausage meat.
But let's be fair. We're talking about an Uncle Mike's. That is absolutely a cellulose sausage casing. they're not good enough to be natural casing.
Now, I'd like to point out that when David said holster clips, what he really meant was holster magazines. Thank you.
That's awesome. Even though the holidays are over, Oddball has compiled a list of knives that, in his opinion, either make great gifts or might be a good choice for you to spend your holiday money on.
Welcome to Oddball's Corner Pocket. I'm recording this a couple days after Christmas, so, of course, gifts are on my mind. If you're like me, there's a couple of folks that you still haven't figured out gifts for, or you're staring at that shiny Amazon gift card and wondering what to get. With that in mind, I figured I'd list some recommendations for sharp, pointy things. Of course, this list will be far from exhaustive. Most of these knives are ones that I either owned, or have at least handled. Even then, I have to pare them down a good bit, or we'll be here all day. Of course, there will be a bunch of links in the show notes, so if you're interested in a particular one, check those out. It's probably best to start with what are called traditional folders. These are the knives that your dad used to carry. Almost everything in this category are slip joints. None of them have pocket clips, and none of them have any of the locking devices I described in episode 35. For the entry level, I would go with an Opinel number 6. This is a true no-frills knife from France. It's a friction folder with the blade pinned into a solid wooden handle. Since the original design, they have added a sleeve that you can rotate to lock the blade. While this is a very secure locking mechanism, it's very much a two-handed job. The number 6 is actually one of their smaller knives with a blade just 2.75 inches long. While I usually go for larger knives, the number 6 slips into the pocket very nicely. I have a number 8 with a 3.35 inch blade, and it takes up a good bit of room in my pocket. In my opinion, the extra bulk isn't worth the roughly half inch of extra blade length you get. You can get these knives in both carbon steel and 12C27 stainless steel. I don't see any practical reason to go with the carbon steel, and have left a link to the stainless steel one in the show notes, and it will run you about $13. For the mid-range, I would recommend, frankly, anything by Case. There's a reason that they've been making knives since the turn of the 20th century. They make a bunch of different configurations with a ton of different handle materials. As an example, I like their Trapper with amber bone handles. While you definitely can spend more, you can get a lot of Case knives for around $50. For something that looks a little bit more modern, I'd recommend the Spyderco Rody. It's a little slip joint that easily slips into the coin pocket of your jeans and uses higher-end steel. As a bonus, it comes in several different colors. Even though it's a tiny little knife, it's actually really comfortable in the hand. Of course, we can't talk about traditional knives without talking about Swiss Army knives. As far as I'm concerned, there's really only one company to look at, and that's Victorinox. Whether you're going for the little classic or something larger, they're nice knives for light use. Next, let's move to the more modern knives. These are all locking, have pocket clips, and can be deployed one-handed. At the low end, I highly recommend the Ontario Rat No. 1. It's kind of the gold standard for budget knives. It's well built, and there are 4 mount points on the pocket clip, so you can carry it in whatever configuration you want. It doesn't have a flipper tab, but the action is smooth enough that you can easily flick it open using the blade studs. I like the larger size of the Rat No. 1, but they also make a smaller version called the Rat No. 2 if you have smaller hands. It's probably no surprise that my recommendation for a mid-range knife is the Spyderco Endura. It was my introduction to the idea that there were better knives out there than the Gerbers that you can pick up discount at Walmart. And it's ridden in my pocket more days than not for over a decade. It has solid construction, made with better steel than you'll see in the budget range, feels good in the hand, and is pretty lightweight and thin. The biggest complaint I've heard about it is if you like smaller knives. Conveniently, Spyderco does make the Delica, which is basically a scaled-down version of the Endura. In my opinion, these are some of the best knives you can get for under $100. Once you get into the under $200 price point, there are some really interesting knives out there. It's honestly really hard to select just one, but I think I'll go with the Benchmade Contigo. It's a bit big and scary, but man, it just fits your hand like it was meant to be. Benchmade's access lock is a thing of beauty, and I often find myself absentmindedly flicking my smaller 940 open and closed. Add to that the Contigo using M4 steel, and it's definitely worth the roughly $200 price point. The last category I'll talk about tonight is what I call a dress knife. These are the knives that you wouldn't feel self-conscious breaking out while wearing a suit. They tend to have a little bit of bling to them, but are still perfectly functional. Unfortunately, like all nicer looking things, this category is a little bit more expensive. For the budget knife, one good option is the Kershaw Leek. It's a nice, slim knife that disappears in your pocket. While the assisted opening can startle some folks, The design is very non-aggressive. The very thin blade profile does mean that it's a bit delicate, but this is a knife for opening envelopes and cutting the stray thread from your pants, not serious survival work. This knife can also be found in a rainbow of different colors and other options, some of which can push this knife into a different price category. That said, I really like the look of the one with the composite blade using D2 sandwiched between 14C29N and a layer of copper brazing between the two. When you get into the mid-range, you can get into a lot of very interesting knives. One example is my current dress knife, a Boker Quaken. Specifically, I have a Blade HQ exclusive Quaken with a brass bolster and micarta handle. Like I said earlier, dress knives tend to have a bit of bling to them, and this one does a good job of delivering that. I decided to really jump up in the price range for the high-end knife in this category. As an example of what you can get if you're willing to throw enough money at it, there's the Chris Reeves Manundi. Chris Reeves is one of those names that, while it may not be well known to the mainstream world, he's extremely well known and respected in the knife world. In fact, Chris Reeves is the guy that came up with the frame lock. With the Manundi, there's a wide selection of options to choose from. For my example, I decided to choose the one with a Damascus blade with Makassar ebony handle inlay. It's just a beautiful knife to me, while still being understated. Of course, there is some bad news with this knife, and that's the price. This particular example will currently run you $595 on Knife Center, and frankly, that's a lot of money for a knife. It's too much for me, but if you're the kind that's in a suit every day and there's a couple Mercedes living in your garage, this might be a good choice for you. Finally, there is always the option of going with a semi-custom shop. I have a little backlock from Santa Fe Stoneworks. It has some really lovely stone inlay in the handle, and I don't think it would be out of place at all in a suit pocket. Like I said at the beginning, this list is far from exhaustive. There were multiple spots here where I was arguing with myself for quite a while as to which knife to go with. I also tried very hard not to keep going with one company or another. After all, I could probably pick a knife for every roll from manufacturers like CRKT, Kershaw, Spyderco, or Benchmade. Oh, and this is probably one of those segments where it will be extremely helpful to check out the links in the show notes. I am going to ask for some feedback on this one. Is there a category that you'd really like recommendations that I haven't hit? Maybe fixed blades or straight up knives for jackassery? Or did I miss a really good knife that I should have talked about? I'd love to continue that conversation with you guys in the ACP Facebook group. Beyond that, if you have any questions, comments, or suggestions for future segments, please feel free to send me a line at oddball@gunscarstech.com or on the ACP Facebook page. I also write at gunscarstech.com. Until next time, have a good one.
Let me just say that I am surprised to hear Oddball state that there is a knife which he considers to be too expensive and not worth the money. Just wow.
I've got to say, like, yeah, no, I wasn't super versed in a few of them, but not many of them. And yeah, I was compiling the show notes before the show. And so I'm just like, yeah, clicking on all those links and going, ooh, pretty. There was definitely a knife porn moment. On the you finished looking at the knife porn and closed 7 tabs.
And I'm spent. So weird. It's
yes.
A new year. Mm-hmm. And after a long absence, your favorite segment is back. The return of the return of the house dick. Now, weird, what does the house dick have in store for us this week?
Steve's going to tell us a sordid tale on how easy a retrieval of a GPS tracker can go, and how poorly.
Good afternoon, everybody, and Happy New Year. This is your friendly neighborhood trunk monkey back with another tale from the trunk. In this week's episode, I'm going to recount some of the great lengths that I go to in order to recover devices I use in order to make my life easier. Air quotes. Easier. So, earlier this last week, I closed out on three separate cases, all three of which had those handy-dandy expensive GPS devices in play. I had been finishing up the day's work on another case, and I made a note to sweep through good old Motor City to pick up my expensive gizmos, as their batteries were running low, and I needed to send out my invoices prior to the New Year's holiday weekend. And, of course, as Murphy would have it, my evening started easy enough, with the first recovery before the sun set on the day at, like, oh, I'd say 4:30. 4:45, it was about a brisk 40 degrees, and the skies were only partly cloudy. I rolled up on my target car, and in true ninja form, I swooped in, grabbed the device, and returned to my vehicle, all in under 10 seconds. Easy peasy! The next one would make my evening progressively more complex. I make the 30-minute drive through the middle of town to target number 2, and I get about a mile away, and boom, the car is on the move, and I get all the alerts and triggers on my phone. And I'm sliding now into rush hour traffic in the rain, and I give chase. I follow the guy as he hits a few fast food drive-thrus and a few residential houses, as he apparently works part-time as a Uber Eats or a Grubhub delivery dude. I don't have the opportunity to make an attempt to recover my expensive device until he arrives at a Little Caesars pizza joint. Now, for those of you that don't know, Little Caesars is the home to the $5 hot and ready. And in the hood, everyone from the hookers to the homeless guys know that if they can score a 5, they can get themselves a calorie-laden meal to tide them over to the next day. This particular store is one of their busier ones, with a complete glass front end and a small standing-room-only lobby in front of a counter, with no options, of course, for dining in. And they happen to pass your pie through a bulletproof Lazy Susan built into the countertop. Now, it had been raining and cold for at least a steady 20 minutes, and I slid into the parking lot, and I had both my front windows down. I happen to leave them open so I have a clear field of view through the tint, and to watch for my target's possible return to their vehicle. And no sooner do I pull into the parking lot, I haven't even thrown my car in park, I'm approached by a homeless guy looking to score some cash for a pizza, and I roughly brush him off and hop out of the ninja wagon. I check my surroundings and notice that the packed parking lot and business, no one happens to be looking outside. As it turns out, the homeless guy who had accosted me as I pulled into the parking lot had scuttled across the street to the Captain J's fish and seafood restaurant. So I crouch down behind my target's car and make an attempt to retrieve the device. I had forgotten that I had placed it way up inside the bodywork, and I also noticed that my knee is suddenly very, very, very damp and f***ing cold. The son of a gun had happened to park in the middle of a gigantic puddle, and in the hood, every puddle happens to have those rainbow swirls of various colors from various vehicular and probably human fluids. And it gets worse. The way that this particular car was built, and I had to get down on the ground. I actually had to lay down on my back and side to get underneath this particular foreign monstrosity. And it was just enough to recover the device. I managed to fish it out of the bodywork and stood up. I was soaked fully down one side of my body, and it was not fun. And I was also covered in a bunch of parking lot grit. So I managed to roll out with a second device and head for the third. Another 30 minutes of sitting in the car and driving back towards home, and hopeful for a glass of whiskey, I make my third pickup, under the watchful eye of a house with a series of surveillance cameras. My target vehicle happened to be in the street, and the device was affixed in a way that I would not be seen on camera if I simply rolled up alongside the vehicle, set 1 foot outside of my truck, reached down, grabbed the device, and drove on. Sometimes the work is dirty, and it ends up turning soggy. And I happen to smell like motor oil that night. If we happen to get any snow this winter, I'll have to break out a flattened piece of cardboard box for device placement and removal so I don't leave any body prints or footprints in the snow. As of right now, 7 days into the new year, We haven't had any snow or any accumulation to speak of this entire season. So, as always, guys, stay warm, stay dry, keep your nose clean, stay ninja. I'll see you next time.
Aaron, I gotta say, there was, when I was growing up, there was a Little Caesar's Pizza in my hometown, and we frequented it quite a bit. I never quite realized that it was also the ghetto pizza.
I actually have nothing useful to add, because growing up, I was so white and so sheltered. So, no, sorry, I don't get anything about ghetto pizza.
So, needless to say, our Little Caesars did not have the bulletproof Lazy Susan. Oh, glad you made it, Steve. Sorry you smelled bad.
Yeah, he showed me some pictures. I don't know if he'll let us post them or not, but there were pictures taken after he came in, and he is pretty thoroughly coated.
Oh, man. Yeah, we'll have to try to talk him into that.
It looked like a miserable night. Oh, dear. Thanks to each and every one of our listeners, and a very special thanks to all our supporters on Patreon. To become a Patreon patron, go to patreon.com/AssortedCalibersPodcast to sign up. Patrons get an early release of the podcast, plus bonus content like our hilarious blooper reels, the ACP film tracks, and the ACP mag dump. You can get more from Weird at his blog, which is weirdworlds.com. That's weirdworlds.com. And you can hear him weekly on Handgun Radio on the Firearms Radio Network.
And you can get more from Erin on her nerd blog, which is lurkingrhythmically.blogspot.com. Also, bluecollarprepping.blogspot.com. Also, she is a big f***ing deal on Operation Blazing Sword and the Pink Pistols.
Thanks to Nate Spencer for our music.
Normally, I read the parts about me, and she reads the parts about her. This outro is assorted, and so is our podcast. Good night, everybody.
Good night.